American movies have become synonymous with Los Angeles. In fact, even the word Hollywood has become shorthand for our film industry. But a new series starting today and running on Tuesday through August 10th at Film Forum sets out to correct that impression. It's called Hollywood on the Hudson, which is also the title of a comprehensive reference book by film historian Richard Kozarski. He returns to our show today, along with Ron Hutchinson, founder of the Vitaphone Project, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hi.
Thank you.
Good to see you again.
How important was New York and its surroundings to early film history, Richard?
Well, early film history was all here. And everyone knows Edison invented the movies in New Jersey. Then you have the Biograph Studio and D.W. Griffith and Fort Lee. And then the history books say it disappeared. It went away.
So it was mostly New Jersey?
It was New Jersey during World War I. They built many studios in Fort Lee because they had the space and the people in Fort Lee would put up with it.
But it was also Union Square. It was in Queens, Astoria.
After
Why certain locations and not others?
Fort Lee was popular because it had been a location site from around 1978. They were very good different things. You could point the camera in different directions and see a big building, a farm. You know. Mm-hmm. They kept going every day. D.W. Griffith's company would come on the ferry every day. And finally, some of the studios said, well, why don't we just like build a stage here? And then maybe we'll build a covered stage here. And when you have a few stages, then you would have a laboratory and all these support facilities. And it was quite active until the end of World War I when the bubble burst.
So most of the earliest stars would have been associated with New York, and D.W. Griffith being a key factor in the history of film, his presence here until when?
Well, Griffith is here until about 1913, and he leaves for the West Coast because he's going to make big films that need a lot of land, like The Birth of a Nation and Intolerance. And he makes those films, and those are the films that put Hollywood on the map. But 4 or 5 years later, 1919, he comes back to New York. He's fed up with Hollywood. He comes back to New York. He says, this is where the money and the brains are. He's an independent filmmaker. He needs to get financing for his films the way a modern filmmaker did, and so he came back.
Well, but that was true for all films that were made in Hollywood, wasn't it? They were all being financed by people in New York.
But they weren't being financed on an individual basis. You would have a program. You would say Metro Corporation or Famous Players, and we're going to do 26 films, and it's a package, and we have a deal with theaters. And Griffith was working in this atelier method. He's saying, I'm going to make a film. It may take me a few months to make it. Oh, it's ready now. You know, now I will distribute it.
So he makes Birth of a Nation and Intolerance out west, and then he comes back here to make...
Films like Way Down East and Orphans of the Storm, which are very big films. In fact, Orphans of the Storm is probably the biggest production ever made in the East.
And then others came back as well, Fatty mm-hmm. Arbuckle, the Talmadge sisters, mm-hmm. For the same reason?
Yes, they wanted to get away from Hollywood. Fatty Arbuckle in particular had a lot of problem with Mack Sennett. Couldn't get along with Mack Sennett. Many of his comedians, Chaplin split, went elsewhere. Mack Sennett's Keystone was tied in with a rental stage in Fort Lee. So Arbuckle goes, well, I'll work in Fort Lee for a while. He works in Fort Lee for a while for Sennett, and then he simply splits and goes over to work for Zukor. But by the end of World War I, 1918, the air had gone out of this balloon. The flu epidemic caused all of the studios in the East to close. There was rationing of coal and electricity, and people said, hey, we've got these studios in the West Coast anyway. Let's just move everything there. And people were saying it was dead. They would never make features again. But 1920, Paramount and Griffith and Fox all built large new studios in the East.
And how long did they survive?
Well, the Paramount studio is still there. It's now the Kaufman Astoria studio, and it's not only the only studio in the country that's on the National Register of Historic Places, but I think it's the only one that's been in continuous operation mm-hmm. with a few dead periods since 1920.
Let's get you in here, Ron.
Yeah.
Ron Hutchinson, founder of the Vitaphone Project. What is the Vitaphone Project? Why do we need it?
Well, we desperately need it. The Vitaphone Project really is a project that started with a bunch of record collectors around 1991, and the idea was to look for the 16-inch shellac soundtrack discs that accompanied the earliest successful sound films that Warner Brothers made, where the sound was not on the film as it is now, but was on a separate but supposedly synchronized 33 1/3 disc that's turning and that's recorded at the same time, and then in the theater it would be synchronized and played back.
Was this before The Jazz Singer?
This was about a year and a half before The Jazz Singer. The Jazz Singer basically came out after quite a few shorts and some features with just music and sound effects synchronized by the Warner Brothers. None of the other Hollywood studios wanted anything to do with making talking pictures. It was always synonymous with how do you lose money in the movie industry? What's the latest crazy idea to make talking pictures? So these discs over the years were lost, broken, destroyed. So you have a lot of orphan mute film sitting around with vaudeville acts, opera stars, comedy, Jack Benny, Burns and Allen. Many of these folks made films in Brooklyn. And we seek out and have found since we've started about 3,500 of these discs, believe it or not, worldwide in private hands, and have matched them up working with Warner Brothers and UCLA to actually be able to see them again, some of which we'll see next week at Film Forum.
So they were made where in Brooklyn?
Avenue M and East 14th Street is the old Vitagraph Studios, which was a silent studio that Richard writes about in his book, built in 1907. Warner Brothers bought Vitagraph when they were kind of failing in 1925 and decided they were going to make talking pictures there. But it's right next to the elevated subway, had glass windows that the pigeons would peck on, the worst place to make talking pictures. So they soundproofed it and made shorts until 1939 with Bob Hope. Jimmy Stewart's very first film, getting slapped around by Shemp Howard of the Three Stooges, was made there.
Because no longer using this separate method of recording.
Well, they used that until about 1930, and then even Warner Brothers said, this is, you know, a la Singing in the Rain, the disc doesn't match the picture, hard to edit, and so on. So even by 1930, Warner Brothers got out of that business.
What happens when we do find the short and the recording? Can they be screened cleverly together, or would you prefer to stick them on to the film optically?
Well, almost all we do is, working with UCLA, is to have them professionally matched. They basically clean up the picture, match the sound, and make a new print, which is what we'll be showing. So there are a few of those old projectors and turntable units still kicking around, but not many.
And old films keep on popping up. Are you assuming that there are still some in people's attics or basements?
Film turns up, even though it's nitrate and very unstable, more so discs. Discs, we probably hear about 30 or 40 a month, believe it or not, through the internet, people finding these things and matching with some mute film.
And you'll be showing, holding a special night at the Film Forum on July 20th.
Yes.
What will you be showing there?
Well, we'll be showing, for the first time since they were screened over 80 years ago in the United States, a bunch of vaudeville shorts with folks who were big in vaudeville, filmed their act almost intact, got paid a couple of $1,000s, and then helped to kind of destroy vaudeville by promoting talking pictures. But we'll be showing, Oklahoma Bob Albright and his Vodeo Dough Flappers, which how can you not like that? We have a wonderful vaudeville act with Jimmy Conlon and his wife. Jimmy Conlon was later in all those Preston Sturges movies. One of these guys, you'd know him if you saw him, started in vaudeville. And a harpist who also tap dances. So we got the full gamut.
My guests are Ron Hutchinson, founder of the Vitaphone Project, and Richard Kozarski, whose book Hollywood on the Hudson is published by Rutgers University Press, available now in paperback. And we're talking about some of the films that were shot in the New York area, silent and sound, until, I guess, well, maybe it still continues to some degree, but there's going to be a festival starting tonight, in fact, at Film Forum and running through August 10th every Tuesday night. So what did happen? There were some studios you suggest, Richard, held out, but in the end, New York just became a place where they did some location shots, and then they had fake New York in the back lot.
This is the other side, the bookend of the story, right? It begins with Edison and Griffith and Fort Lee, and then today we have Martin Scorsese and Sidney Lumet people like this coming out of the New York film schools, and all of the work in the Paramount Kaufman studio, and people told me when I was a film student that nothing had happened in the middle. Everything went to Hollywood, and then when Hollywood fell apart, well, it came back. And I asked, why did it come back to New York?
Well, you said when it fell apart, the studio system fell apart.
The studio system, yes.
And so sudden independent films became the norm, and you can make independent films anywhere.
Right. Why would they come here? It's always more expensive to make a film in New York. I mean, Woody Allen famously says he made films in New York because he likes to sleep in his own bed at night, right? Now, Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton might have said that about the films they made in Hollywood. Oh, I like to sleep in my own bed at night. No one would have thought that was funny, right? But it's funny because Woody Allen's films are of New York. He doesn't just happen to be shooting here because it's a convenience for
him. Although one of his funniest moments is a scene in Los Angeles. Was it Annie Hill Hall that where he tries to drive? Anyway, that's I don't remember.
But that's a lot later than the period that the film forum is concentrating on. The film forum is really talking about this early 1930s period. Mm-hmm. And specifically, they have a lot of the films that were made in the Paramount studio because although things had again tapered off at the end of the silent period, they said this is over, sound films are invented. And A, the engineers are here. They want to be close to Western Electric, but also the talent is here. So in the beginning of the sound era, every major, quote, Hollywood studio was making some of their short production here in the New York
area. They could just draw from all the stars on Broadway. They'd be on Broadway at night, come out to the studios, make a good buck filming an act or doing something. Eddie Cantor's first films were made out at Astoria. Burns and Allen, Jack Benny.
The Marx Brothers.
Marx Brothers made their first two features out of Astoria, Animal Crackers and the Coconuts. So it was very easy for them and to just draw on that talent.
Mm-hmm. And then during World War II, the government started making films here as well. And it's interesting that when in the early days of television, everything was done in New York. And then we see the same process. Everything moves out to Hollywood. I mean, CSI New York is shot in Hollywood.
Yeah. Well, you talked about after the war, there were location films. You know, there was On the Town, there was The Naked City. Part of the reason for the fact that this renaissance on the waterfront happened with exteriors, you know, location films, A, is that the studio interiors were decrepit or owned by the Army, the Signal Corps owned the Pictorial Center, but also because this is the sort of film that people knew how to make in New York. They knew how to shoot on the streets. They knew how to take advantage of locations. They knew how to do sound on the streets. In a sense, it was, you know, making, getting a lemon, but, you know, turning it into lemonade, because that becomes, you know, sort of the default style of the independent American cinema in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s.
And now we're seeing new lots being formed in the old Brooklyn Navy Yard.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean that New York is going to have another renaissance?
It's very much tied to economics, not only the economics and health of the film industry. And, of course, by the film industry, we mean also television and the whole moving image business in general. But also, what are our tax benefits? What sort of bennies, you know, can be offered to people either in New York City or in New Jersey? It's very sensitive, cost sensitive.
Well, I was hoping when the Canadian dollar got strong that they'd start using New York as a stand-in for Toronto. Richard, you'll be introducing The Scoundrel tonight at 7:35, one of two Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur features. They were also filmed here?
Absolutely. Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur, two screenwriters. Again, they were famous for writing and rewriting Hollywood films, right? But they, especially Hecht, had contempt for the notion that six, seven, eight writers would go on to a film. In 1934, there's an offer from Western Electric. Western Electric, the phone company, has a sound system they're promoting, and they have also taken control of that studio in Astoria, right? And Western Electric is trying to make sure that if there's any independent production going along, they're not going to use the RCA sound system. So Western Electric begins a financing project where they basically put up the money for films. They put up the money for The Emperor Jones. They put up the money for the Hecht and MacArthur films. They also put up the money for the educational sound comedies,
yep.
You know, goofy comedies. And Hecton MacArthur sort of seized on this opportunity to say, this is what an independent can do, you know, without Hollywood. Unfortunately, there's something that was also lacking in their production, which was sort of the ability to supervise themselves. Yeah. And the wonderful quality of these films, the sort of untrammeled New York equality.
Well, interesting, it stars Noel Coward, but will we recognize any of the locations?
Oh, considering the fact that these are two, you know, famous New York films, they're about New York. They deal with these, you know, egocentric elite New Yorkers. There's hardly any scenes shot on the streets at all. I mean, Hecton MacArthur, they didn't want to go out and do that. They just wanted to have things in the studio. And of course, Hecht says directing those films was simply a matter of, you know, having the actors recite what we put down in the script. Mm-hmm. So much so that famously, they often did not come down from NIAC. They would telephone the directions into the cameraman, Lee Garms, who has co-director credit.
Now, Ron, can our listeners play a part in the Vitaphone project?
Absolutely. I don't think there's a month goes by that somebody doesn't contact me at the project and say, you know, we found this stack of these 16-inch shellac records. They had, say, MGM or Warner Brothers on them. Certainly anybody who finds either film or what looks like a soundtrack disc, we would love to hear from them because we can then match them up if they match a film.
And a soundtrack disc would be larger than a 12?
Oh, yeah, 16-inch black shellac, usually has a studio's name on the label somewhere in the title of the film somewhere there. And a lot of them were just not shipped back to Warner Brothers like they were supposed to. They just remained in theaters, went home with people and so on. So they're still turning up today.
And you'll be showing some of them, as I said, as part of the festival on July 20th, the Vitaphone Varieties of 2010, featuring early talkie vaudeville shorts going into the 30s.
Yeah, well, it's mainly 1926 to 30, so we really stop at 30. Almost all of them were shot in Brooklyn, by the way.
And I want to thank both of you for being on our show today, Ron Hutchinson, founder of the Vitaphone Project, and Richard Kozarski, whose book, Hollywood on the Hudson, is published by Rutgers University Press. He'll be introducing a couple of films tonight at Film Forum as part of the series, which will be running every Tuesday through August 10th. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All the details you need on our website at WNYC.org.